you're going to be on campus this weekend, you're going to hear this. Ah, dear old pomp and circumstance. Oh, just tugs at the heartstrings, doesn't it? Welcome to Let's Talk for a Wednesday morning program. Scott here with you. Again, our friend Jeff Byers, he'll be back tomorrow. He's on assignment again, eating this morning. Where do I sign up? I got to get that. But anyway, we'll have some more open line time later on this hour. But in the meantime, let's welcome our guest, John Marcus from the Hechinger Report, covers higher education. John, first off, good morning. Thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me back.
You're welcome. Yeah, it's been a little while, but I thought, you know, this week for Penn State at least, end of the semester, finals week, pomp and circumstance, all that fun stuff is going on this week. I thought, all right, this is good timing. So, John, I've got a bunch of questions to ask you from some stories that you've covered recently and just, I don't know, higher ed in general, chaos. I'm not sure if that's the right word. Maybe it is. We'll find out from you here in just a little bit. But first off, let's start off, if you would, for folks that didn't hear you when you were on with us. This was last year, actually. If you would, tell us something about yourself, your background, what do you cover, and then tell us about the Hechinger Report, which I'm a subscriber. I think you guys do great work. So tell us something about you and tell us something about the report. Go ahead.
Well, like a lot of journalism these days, Hechinger is a nonprofit that covers higher ed. Well, we cover all of education. My beat is higher ed. We also cover, my colleagues cover K through 12. Our stories run in national media, NPR, the Washington Post, the New York Times, and local media to sort of help, readers see what's going on in higher education. It's not a particularly transparent industry, or it hasn't been historically. And a lot of what we're going to talk about today speaks to that. What we think, the way we think about higher education is a little bit of a mythology, that it's hard to get into college, for example, when in fact it's becoming much easier to get into college, that tuition continues to go up, when in fact, when adjusted for inflation, tuition is going down, although obviously it's still very expensive. So that's the kind of journalism that we do.
All right, John, you've seen my question list because you just hit a bunch of things right there. That's very good. Now, you write stories. You also have a podcast series called College Uncovered that I believe you do with a partner. Right off the bat, what is this podcast, and is this available on all the podcast outlets? Where can folks find those?
Yes, absolutely. College Uncovered is free on any number of podcast channels. You can get it from PRX. It's an NPR podcast. We team up with an NPR affiliate in Boston, GBH in Boston, and it speaks directly to consumers. So if you're a student or a family of a student or a prospective student, we don't really talk as much as we do in our journalism about things like policy or politics. We talk about what you need to know, how you can get more financial aid, some of the issues that I mentioned earlier about how tuition's actually going down, but the prices that are really going up, as many of your students and their parents might already know, is dorms and dining, which people perceive these to be kind of break-even products and services that universities provide. In fact, universities make about 13% of their revenue from those things, and their prices are going up much faster than inflation, but tuition's going down. So a lot of information that might help families and students make decisions about where to go to college, how to get the most out of their education, and how to get their educations at the best possible price.
So in other words, John, they get you somehow going one way or the other. Would that be accurate?
You know, they get you even, it's graduation season, as you mentioned. A lot of universities, this is mind-blowing, after all of the bills and the fees and the housing and the dining plans, they charge you a graduation fee. And I've written about students who didn't know they had to pay a graduation fee and as a result couldn't get their transcripts or their degrees. Without their degrees or transcripts, they couldn't get a job. Without a job, they couldn't pay their graduation fee. So there's a lot of things that still happen in higher education that make no logical sense.
Oh, for goodness sakes. All right, now, John Scott here. I'm kind of old. All right, I graduated college 40 years ago. Did they have these fees and stuff back then, or is this a new
thing? Yeah, so the fees have always existed, but they've accelerated significantly. There was some research that just came out this week that showed that fees are increasing much faster than tuition. So what often happens, especially at public universities and colleges, is that legislatures ban them from raising tuition. So what they do to get around that is they raise fees, and there are litanies of fees. We did a story about this a few years ago, and we found a fee that cost, I'm not making this up, $4,000 a semester, and it was called the Academic Excellence Fee. And you would think that academic excellence is included, but they charged extra, $4,000 a semester. This was for a graduate program at a public university in New York City. And they wouldn't tell us what it was for until we filed a public records request. And it was for a lot of things that you expect you just get out of tuition. So fees are a price by another name. They've always been around, yes, but universities are resorting to them increasingly. They make it hard for people to budget how much money to set aside for college because they don't always know about these fees in advance. There are a few places that have eliminated fees or rolled them into the tuition to make costs more predictable for students. But for the most part, fees often can surprise students, especially fees that cost $4,000 a semester, and they can derail students because the students just run out of money.
Very interesting. Now, all right, this is maybe connected. So I was doing prep work for our interview and your podcast, again, folks, called College Uncovered. Check it out. You guys have a line in there that says, colleges don't want you to know how they operate. Mm-hmm. Now, first off, I quoted that right. And then my next question, I guess, is why? Why can't they just be straightforward, John? I don't understand.
You know, that's a great question. I wish I could answer. But I will tell you what we mean by that is that, for instance, there's a mythology in America that it's really hard to get into college. In fact, 80% of applicants to college collectively are accepted. We tend to focus on these incredibly selective institutions like Brown that takes 1 out of 20 applicants or Stanford or Harvard. Those are great to aspire to institutions like that, but their selectivity is very high and their acceptance rates are very low. In general, it's not that hard to get into college, and it's actually 8 percentage points easier than it was 10 years ago because the number of students, as I think you will discuss, the number of students is going down. The number of 18-year-olds is going down, especially in states like Pennsylvania. And so this mythology benefits universities because, of course, if you're selling something, you want people to think that they're lucky that you're even talking to them, that you're even considering admitting them to your institution. In fact, it's a buyer's market, and they need you right now more than you need them.
Very interesting. All right, let's continue down that lane. A term that it's a pretty famous term now, I've used it a bunch of times, is the enrollment cliff, which I guess is hitting right about now, or maybe it's next year. John, first off, for folks who aren't familiar, what is the enrollment cliff? What is this thing? And why are colleges probably everywhere fretting over this? What's going on?
Yeah, this is, you mentioned that it's graduation week. If I ran a college or a university, I would be so glad that this year is over. You cannot imagine a greater perfect storm of problems facing universities and colleges. Much of it underneath the chaos that you read about every day in the news, the political attacks and the culture wars. And the most significant one for universities and colleges is this enrollment cliff or demographic cliff, where the number of 18-year-olds is about to decline. Why? Because people have fewer children during economic downturns, and if you think about it, one of the biggest economic downturns in the history of this country was almost exactly 16 years ago in 2008. During the Great Recession, people started having fewer children. Children cost money. Child care cost money. Fast forward 18 years, that hits next year. So this current class of graduating high school seniors is the last big class. And then it goes down steadily until 2039. There'll be 650,000 fewer 18-year-olds every year. That's a big hit for universities. It goes up slightly, and now there's a prediction of a second cliff beginning in 2041, a second decline. So there's just not enough customers for universities, and that's about to hit, as you said, next year.
Now, this is, I mean, this isn't a precipitous dive. This is just a very gradual numbers going down, right, John? It's not, this is not like literally going off a cliff. Isn't this more of a gradual thing?
I'm looking actually at a graph of this cliff, and it's actually a pretty steep decline, but it's important to keep in mind that this follows an 11% decline in enrollment already. There's millions fewer college students than there were 10 years ago. Because after 2011, another thing that happens in economic downturns is that people go back to college. Often they've lost their job, they want to reskill, they want to get promoted, and that happened until about 2011, and then people stopped going to college. That hit most acutely at community colleges. Enrollment went down 37%. In four-year universities and colleges, enrollment went way down. I mean, you're seeing that in Pennsylvania. You've been seeing that for quite a while. This demographic cliff will hit unevenly. It's already been underway in the Northeast and the Midwest. What happens next year is it hits most of the country. There are still some states where the number of 18-year-olds is going up, and we can talk about that because those are very specific groups of 18-year-olds that are going up that universities have not had a good record enrolling, and now they have to figure out a way to recruit them, namely Hispanic 18-year-olds. That's the only growth area for colleges, the only racial and ethnic group that is increasing in number is Hispanic. The number of white and black and Asian students is going down. So that creates more problems for universities. They their acceptance rates are going up because they have fewer applicants. They have to dole out more financial aid in the competition for those students. There's obviously now going to be, it seems logical, a big dip in the number of international students. 10% of the undergrads at Penn State are international. Are they going to keep coming? Would you? When you're reading in India and China right now about geopolitical tensions and about visas being revoked and students being deported. So all of these things are coming at the same time, and all of them will affect students, and they'll not only affect students, but by the way, that decline in the number of international students who pay full tuition, fewer of them mean American students will have to pay more. They're essentially the international market has been subsidizing U.S. students. International students bring $43 billion a year to the United States. That number is also almost certainly going to go down. It already is. It's been going down even before this current presidential administration. The very widely publicized steps this administration has been taking that affect international students will only likely bring those numbers down some more.
Well, I have a note about the Hispanic students. I saw that story of yours that, okay, there's one going up. Now, John, does that, how do I phrase this? Does that benefit certain schools over other schools? I've never been a believer in taking a group of people, in this case, Hispanic students, and think, okay, they all think and act alike. I've never been a fan of that. And any other group that's out there. But as far as if this is a growing number of students, does that maybe, I don't know, benefit certain schools or certain areas of the country as opposed to other areas? We're up here in Pennsylvania in the Northeast. Maybe Hispanic students, this is not a hot place to go if you're an Hispanic student. Am I right on any of that?
Yes, there's a number of answers to those questions. One is, as you say, Hispanics aren't monolithic. There are many Hispanic families in rural places, including in Pennsylvania. Whether Hispanic young people from Texas will want to move to Pennsylvania, that's a different question. Will it benefit certain states more than others? There are some states where there is no demographic cliff, thanks predominantly to Hispanic students, such as Texas. They are not going to see a decline in the number of 18-year-olds, but what they will see is every other state in America going after those same students, trying to get them to move to Pennsylvania or New England or the Midwest. And some institutions will benefit. There's a new designation called Hispanic Serving Institutions. Those are institutions with large numbers of Hispanic students. And I take your point and agree with you that, you know, not everyone in a particular group is the same. But I think it's human nature for all of us, no matter what our backgrounds, to want to be around other people like us. And so Hispanic Serving Institutions will benefit. And some institutions that have done a really good job of having a strategy of attracting Hispanic students will do well. I went to a small Catholic university outside Chicago to report that story, and they have slowly, a lot of Hispanic students, a lot of Hispanic families in Chicago, they have done a lot of small things like provided Spanish language orientation for parents who might not speak English, who are immigrant, legally documented American immigrants to the United States from Spanish-speaking countries, whose English still isn't that good and who need their children to translate. I spoke to students who were so grateful that the school provided translation for their parents so that they didn't have to do it. Little things like that. Now, there's a lot of concern that the pushback against diversity initiatives could affect those kinds of programs. And we'll see if that happens too, because colleges, again, right now really need to attract and support and retain Hispanic students. That's the one growth area. If they have support programs for those students, will they have to cancel them, because of all the pushback against, diversity and equity? That's an open question too. So, even when we set out to do that story, we reached out to a number of colleges and universities that had successfully increased their number of Hispanic students, and they wouldn't talk to us. Colleges and universities are trying to keep a very low profile right now. They don't want to put their heads up and get fired on. So there's a lot to unpack around that.
So colleges and universities, John, either have to or are coming up with unique new angles to attract students. Now, you folks had a story recently about something called direct admission. Can you explain what that is? Because when I read that, I'm thinking, wow, you pretty much just have to show up and you're in. All right, what is direct admission?
This is a fascinating new phenomenon that's grown very quickly. It started in the West in some rural states that were concerned about the proportion of students going on to college. That's another issue that's facing colleges right now. Fewer high school graduates are going to college because they question the value or the return on their investment. In 2016, we hit a peak of 70% of high school graduates nationwide going on to college. That's now fallen from 70% to 62%. That is only exacerbating the demographic changes. Even where there are 18-year-olds, they don't want to go to college anymore. So some of these Western states started a process under which if you met certain academic cutoffs, you were automatically admitted to public universities without even having to apply. This worked fairly well, and now other colleges and universities that are desperate for students are doing the same thing. There's a new process by which people apply to college called the Common App or the Common Application. It means that you only have to fill out one application for several institutions. And not every university or college participates in this, because many of them have their own applications or they have essays they require you to write. But the Common App has grown significantly, and now the Common App allows its member institutions to offer admission to students that didn't apply to them. So you might apply to a particular college through the Common App and suddenly get a letter or an email from a different institution saying, we've already admitted you, and we'll give you this financial aid if you come here. This speaks to the reality that it's not as hard to get into college as people think. Some colleges will come to you even if you don't apply to them. That's how desperate many of them are for students right now.
All right, we'll take a break in a moment. John, the Common App thing, I'm vaguely familiar with that. Now, I mentioned to listeners yesterday, my youngest just turned 30 yesterday. God, I'm old. Holy fright. But I kind of remember this Common App. But one thing I remember about that Common App is, at least here in Pennsylvania, none of the, I'll call them big schools, were on the list, like Penn State or Pitt or Temple or Carnegie Mellon, I don't think. These were like all smaller schools that were in this, I don't know, pool of schools that somehow one application goes to all of them. Is that the case nationwide or is that just here? These were all small schools on the list that I saw.
Yeah, again, not all of the not all of colleges and universities accept the Common App. But more than 1,000 of them do. The more selective universities and colleges, some of them do accept the Common App, but not all of them. It's also a fairly new innovation. It's a nonprofit. It's not a commercial process, but it doesn't make a profit. But it has been increasing the number of colleges, again, there's about 1,000 of them. So not every college will accept it, and that is a national, that's true nationally, but many of them do.
All right, John, let us take a break here. We're talking with John Marcus, who is a reporter for the Hechinger Report covers education issues, and John especially covers higher education issues. Yeah, we're in a different time now. It's kind of wild. Kind of scary, I guess, if you work at a college or university, and we'll get to more of that when we come back from this break. You're listening to Let's Talk on 98.7 The Fox on finals week. That's a coincidence, not really. We will come right back.
Your home for the Goon and Ironhead.
Ironhead and the Goon.
Exclusively on Sports Radio 98.7
The Fox.
Let Sports Radio 98.7 The Fox make you a winner this summer with our Summer Splash Contest with Clearwater Pools and Spas in Center Hall. This Father's Day weekend, The Fox will be giving away a spacious hot springs hot tub during a Belfont cruise at Talleyrand Park in downtown Belfont. Stop by these fine locations and get signed up to become a qualifier for the contest. Dottery Equipment, Route 64 in Mill Hall. Fisher's Market at the Y in Milesburg and at Clearwater Pools and Spas in Center Hall.
The 36th Annual Historic Belfont Cruise coming up Father's Day weekend, June 13th and 14th. Top-notch entertainment all weekend long. It starts out Friday night with an open cruise, a stock-off, the big car show on Saturday with over 30-plus classes of cars, trucks, and motorcycles on display. Plenty of sponsorship opportunities for you. Call 814-280-5881 or visit BelfontCruise.org. That's 814-280-5881 or BelfontCruise.org. The 36th Annual Historic Belfont Cruise, Father's Day weekend, June 13th and 14th.
This year's Penn State Board of Trustees election is about transparency and competence. And Pat Romano is asking for your alumni vote. Pat is a successful local business owner from Phillipsburg and a leader on the World Campus Alumni Board who believes in lowering student tuition, saving Commonwealth campuses, improving the Penn State student experience, and in honoring Joe and Sue Paterno by returning the Joe Paterno statue. Number 3 on your alumni ballot, Pat Romano will focus on Penn State's future and enough of the nonsense. This spring, vote for Pat Romano for the Penn State Board of Trustees.
If you're like me, you have neighbors that have zero-turn mowers, and some are satisfied and others not so much. I've had neighbors come over while I'm mowing with my Kubota and want to try it out. I told Bob and Clyde, you need to get to Daughter Equipment, just south of Mill Hall on Route 64, for Kubota. I have a Z200 25 horsepower with the simplest operation and a pristine cut every time. Even though I have a lawn and, shall we say, a challenging bank, ditch, and of course the wife's ornamental bushes. If you're trying to decide on a great lawn care machine, get to Daughter Equipment, just south of Mill Hall on Route 64. At Daughter Equipment, they're experts on Kubota lawn care machines that keep you moving quickly and efficiently. Your destination for Kubota is Daughter Equipment, just south of Mill Hall on Route 64. You may even meet my neighbors, Bob and Clyde.
Your home for the Goon and Ironhead.
Ironhead and the Goon.
Exclusively on Sports Radio 98.7.
The Fox.
Thank you. And for you high schoolers out there, first off, why aren't you in school? All right, hello, come on. A few weeks for you, right? Penn State this weekend and a few weeks for you. Just wait. You're listening to Let's Talk on 98.7 The Fox. Again, we're talking with our guest, John Marcus, from the Hechinger Report. Folks, these folks are great. I shouldn't say guys. There are plenty of gals, too. They're great. Website, HechingerReport.org. That's spelled H-E-C-H-I-N-G-E-R. HechingerReport.org. John, I've been a financial supporter of you guys for several years because I really like your work. K-12, higher ed, some other areas there. How many people work for the Hechinger Report? It seems like, are you guys growing?
That's a good question. I think there's about 20 of us.
Well, that's not very many. Although, I was expecting more than that.
Yeah, all over the country. Well, we spread ourselves. We do a lot for a small group, and we also work with other journalists, and we partner with other nonprofits and with for-profit media as well on stories that we do together.
All right, now kind of piggybacking on what we were talking about in the last segment, you folks had a story, I think it was just called The Missing Men, where it was, is this right? The breakdown in college right now is women 60%, men 40%. Is that right?
Yep, that's the collective average, and in some institutions even more. We also did a segment about that on our podcast, and we went to a University of Florida that's 70% women. This is actually an international phenomenon in developed nations. More women than men are going to college. And there's a lot of reasons behind it, but the implications of it are worrying. I want to be very clear at the outset, not everybody has to go to college, but somebody has to go to college, and we're... You know, we're running out. Right now, we talked about the number of 18-year-olds being down, but this is happening at the same time as huge numbers of retirements among baby boomers. So we have a lot of people leaving the workforce and not enough people coming into it. So if people, and a lot of people are understandably sort of skeptical about how universities and colleges perform. We've talked about some of the ways that they're not entirely honest with us. People that have gone through the financial aid process will also know that it is, some critics say, purposely confusing to understand how much financial aid you're going to get. There are a lot of other reasons that people are a little jaundiced about higher education. There's a lot of criticism about, this perception that colleges are woke. But we really need them. We really need people to come out with skills to work in the knowledge economy. It's a global competition for people that have the talent that are required by employers. And this decline in the number of 18-year-olds coinciding with the baby boomer retirements is a big problem. And the fact that men are even less likely than women now to go to college means even fewer prospective workers with the skills we need.
Well, if you're a college guy and you need a date, all right, those numbers are great, I suppose. But John, where are the men going? I mean, what are they doing? What they're going somewhere. What's going on?
Yep. So men are more likely than women to go right out of high school into the workforce, into what we used to call blue collar jobs. They are likely to go into the trades, which pay very well, and that's actually a pretty smart decision to make. The problem over time is that often those jobs require manual labor, and when these men turn 50, they can't do them anymore, and they don't have a post-secondary credential to fall back on. And so for some of them, there is this kind of frustration waiting for them down the road that their opportunities might be fewer. But again, there's a lot of nuance here. Women are more likely to go to college because, well, first of all, these proportions used to be reversed. Far more men used to go to college than women. As women have moved into the economy, we encouraged more women to go to college. We didn't encourage men. So we've done a very successful job at encouraging women to go into to go to college. Women also tend to predominate in fields that do require a degree. teaching, social work, nursing. So they're more likely to have to go to college. It doesn't mean they're going to make a ton more money than men. It just means that they happen to choose fields that you need to go to college for. But men, again, based on research that we've reported, are more likely to be disciplined in the lower grades. They're less likely to graduate from high school. All of these things sort of cut into the number of men going to college, and now it's 60-40.
All right. Now, John, we mentioned earlier these colleges and universities have kind of come up with new angles and strategies to try to attract students and so on. Have you come across any situations of schools specifically going after young men to sign up for their school? Are schools starting to do something in that?
Oh, yeah. Many of them are doing that. And in all kinds of different ways. So they'll have focus groups among men to see what they like. Men tend to like programs in entrepreneurship. So one flagship public university, the University of Vermont, started a competition for high school students open to men and women, boys and girls in high school. But it was an international competition. And as they predicted, it tended to attract more men. The prize was a free scholarship to, or 100% free ride at the University of Vermont. But it also exposed a lot of men to the, or high school boys, to that university. And they also do things like promote their athletic program. And the day that most prospective students visit is on Fridays, and they have this thing now at the university on campus where you're all supposed to wear the school colors, the mascot walks around, the band plays, and so that they find is attractive to men. The University of Montana has classes in sustainable hunting and classes in forestry, both of which they found are attractive to men in their market, which is the West, and so they promote those to prospective students, and that's actually worked for them. It's attracted more men to come to University of Montana. Other institutions are expanding their athletic program, which they feel attracts men. That's a riskier bet because it's expensive to do it, and it works about half the time that more men come to your college because you add more tees. So all of these strategies are ways to attract more men. All of them are part and parcel of this need to recruit more students generally.
John, have you ever been to Penn State?
You know, I go to colleges for a living, and I have not ever been to Penn State.
Oh, well, you got to come by and come visit us.
I should.
Yeah,
I should.
I mean, they've got a football team, which is pretty
so
good.
I've heard.
All right.
Yeah, I've read.
Am I crazy? All right, for a university strategy, somehow fold in the football team to high school boys, like, hey, come to Penn State, you can cheer for us, and you'll be great. Something like that. Is that along the lines of what you just described?
Totally. Not only recruiting people to come and cheer on the team, but also to, you know, starting football teams. And these are often the institutions right now that are starting programs are Division II, Division III, not Division I. Division I, it's incredibly expensive, as you also know at Penn State, to have a these high-level football programs or basketball or hockey. So we're talking Division II and III. Even there, on average, it costs about $500,000 a year to start a football program, and there's a risk that it won't attract enough students, or it will attract students that require a lot of scholarship money, and in the end, there's not a revenue advantage. So all of those are calculations universities and colleges are making.
All right, now let's continue that line. I've got a story here. I don't think it was from you guys. I think I just grabbed it somewhere, I think last week. Down in North Carolina, there's a liberal arts school called St. Andrews University that apparently just a week or two ago announced, okay, we're done, and they closed on Monday. Just boom,
yep.
We're done. That's it. We're closing the doors. We're done. I don't know if you're familiar with that particular one, John, but are there a lot of school? It seems every week I see some blurb about a school closing. How many schools are closing right now?
79 since 2020. Whoa. 79 nonprofit universities since 2020.
Whew. And I would assume that's expected to continue.
It's going to get worse.
Now,
because there aren't enough customers. And while I haven't had the privilege of visiting Penn State, I've been to a lot of closed colleges. And it's the saddest thing you've ever seen. But a lot of these institutions, they've seen, I'll be honest with you, they've seen this enrollment decline coming. They didn't do anything about it. They focus on next year's class. They don't plan down the road. The reason that they're so vulnerable to the decline in the number of international students that's likely coming is because they needed those students. The number of international students in graduate programs in the last 10 years is up 70% because those programs, graduate programs generally, are revenue producers for colleges. Many colleges use their graduate programs to subsidize their undergraduate programs. Within those graduate programs, they've kept needing more and more international students to keep them running, and those numbers are already declining. Even before this current presidential administration, the number of international graduate students in the fall declined. So all of those things are ahead for colleges. It's going to be painful, and a lot of them will close.
Now, John, I'm assuming, are all these schools that have closed, you said 79, are these all really small liberal arts schools? I mean, this school, St. Andrews University, I'll be honest, before I saw this story, I never heard of them. Is there any, I hate to say, use the word, major schools or much larger schools that maybe they haven't closed yet, but they're leaning that direction? Do you know of any that might be out there?
Well, the colleges that are in the most trouble right now are small, regional, meaning they don't have a national brand. You know, they don't attract students from all over the country. They're dependent on their own neighborhoods. Religiously affiliated, more than half of the colleges that have closed are religiously affiliated. What else? Single gender, there's still some women's colleges, and they're vulnerable. Colleges don't have big endowments, colleges in rural places. All of those are the ones that are in trouble. Are you seeing a lot of big name colleges? Maybe not. A few are also merging. Gannon University, which I think is in Pennsylvania,
yes,
is merging with Ursuline College in Ohio. Those are both Catholic universities. So there are a number of those that they see the writing on the wall finally. And they are teaming up to preempt this decline in enrollment. Because if you merge, and we're going to see a lot more mergers, and you've seen that in Pennsylvania and in other states among public universities as well, your administrative costs decline because you have one central office serving more students, so your per unit cost, per student cost is lower. You can offer more programs. You're going to see that as well. So you'll see mergers as well as closings. But yeah, there's going to be a lot of closings. There already have been, and they have tended to be in the Northeast and the Midwest, and that's where you're going to see more of them happening.
All right, here's my obvious next question. All right, John, we got Penn State in the backyard, big university. They have a blanket of Commonwealth or branch campuses across not all of Pennsylvania, but a lot of Pennsylvania. And this could happen next week, the announcement that, okay, we're going to close some of these branch campuses for whatever the reasons are that are given. Enrollment, money, Penn State has a budget deficit right now, and so on. John, I honestly don't know this. Big public universities across America, do they all have branch campuses, you know, across their states and so on? Or is Penn State a bit more of an anomaly? Do you know that?
Not exactly an anomaly, but it's a state-by-state kind these are all state systems, so each state is different. Some other states, Vermont, for example, the flagship is independent, but there's a sort of second tier of colleges, the Vermont State Universities, that are all now combined. As in Pennsylvania, they've merged them. In most states, what you have is a flagship that's independent and of the other institutions, and then you have sort of what in the industry is called regional public universities. And those sometimes are affiliated with one another, sometimes independent. Those second-tier I don't mean that in terms of quality. That second level of regional public universities, those are the ones where you're seeing huge budget cuts, huge program cuts, huge cuts in majors. But it's not unique to them. Even some flagships like West Virginia University, you might have read, has made massive cuts in programs. You talk about the financial issues at Penn State. I don't know that Penn State is necessarily, you know, I'm saying this facetiously. I know that Penn State is not in existential trouble. But a lot of public universities are facing those kinds of budget issues. They are a result of enrollment problems that we've been talking about through this segment. You're seeing those kinds of things as well.
All right. Now, I think you folks had a story about online classes versus in-person classes, and yet somehow they're the same cost, and people are complaining about that like that shouldn't be. What can you tell me about that? Is that true?
This is related to what we've been talking about, and it would be hilarious if it wasn't so sad. Technology for every other industry is a way to lower prices, right, and increase productivity. And that was the promise of online higher education. If you think about the history of online higher education, it's an outgrowth of correspondence schools. If you remember these or you've read about them, that they would mail you the textbook and a test, and you'd study and then mail the test back, and they would grade you. Once the internet came into wide use, this kind of thing went online. Initially, for-profit universities like the University of Phoenix tended to dominate the online space. Then big selective universities like MIT created massive courses. They called them massive open online courses, or MOOCs, that thousands or tens of thousands of people all over the world could take at the same time. All of that promised to make higher education cheaper. So online higher education has expanded, and its momentum was accelerated by the pandemic, because even though we all complained about having to go online, students got used to it, and so they've continued to sort of migrate to online higher education. And they expected that it would be cheaper. In a survey, 80% of Americans assume that online higher education should be cheaper. You don't need a classroom. You don't need a building. You don't need an office. You can teach a huge number of people. But in fact, 80% of online courses cost as much as or more than in-person courses. And the reason that that's happening is because while the number of students on campus is declining, colleges need somebody to pay to keep the lights on. And so they're charging higher prices for online courses to basically continue to run the in-person campuses. If you look on social media, students who take online courses are really furious about this, but that's how things have evolved. Even worse, and this one will blow you away, that a quarter of these programs that offer online courses charge an additional fee, a distance learning fee, to their online course, online students. Again, every indication is that these students should be cheaper to educate, and instead colleges are charging them more or the same.
Oh, boy, the fees again. Okay.
The fees again.
Gotta love the fees again. One more quick question, John, and we're done. I don't think I can watch the news any week without seeing a fresh story about an Ivy League school in some kind of trouble. Anti-Semitism, protesting. Harvard has $52 billion they're just sitting on. Why are we handing them more money? You know, all those sorts of stories. Just about a minute or so, just a general open-ended question. What is going on with the Ivy League? Is this really chaotic, or is this much ado about nothing?
Yes and no. I think it's I don't think it's much to do about nothing. I think that they're really easy targets in the culture wars, and that a lot of this, I mean, this is not my opinion. This is just a, I think it would be clear to any objective observer, this is a political, these are political attacks. On the other hand, it is also true that these institutions have not done a particularly good job of making a case for themselves. And, the primary evidence of that was with the congressional hearings where the presidents of Harvard and Penn really did not acquit themselves well, really did not sound like they were understanding the public concerns that were being expressed. So they're victims, I think, of the culture wars. On the other hand, they haven't done a particularly good job, in, for the most part, in responding to those things. So that's why I say that the answer is both yes and no.
All right. That's a fair answer. I'll go with that. That's fine. John, appreciate your time this morning. Again, fascinating stuff. The website, again, folks, is HechingerReport.org. If you have an interest in education and in this town, I figure most folks probably do, definitely check these folks out. They are really great. John, we appreciate your time again, and thanks a lot this morning.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
You're